Welcome, Kelly. Welcome.
Thank you for
thanks,
inviting me.
Thanks
again.
For being here, and we're glad to have Tanya here with us again for the second time around. As I said at the beginning of the part of the program, Philip Graham is gone. He's out of the country. He
but
left.
He's coming back.
He left the United States. He had to go. There was a little trouble with the authorities. You know, maybe we'll get that worked out, and he can come back. But for the moment, he had
no,
to be
you know,
away.
If you want to know what's going on with him, you can go to the McSweeney's website, and he has a he's doing a sort of a monthly piece there.
Oh, well, okay. He and his family are living in Portugal, and they're having a wonderful time, and they're writing, and they're traveling, and I'm sure that they're having a great time. Nothing wrong with the Grahams. Everything's fine. I'm just goofing around.
Poor Philip.
Poor Philip. Oh, I'm sure. Poor Philip. Yeah, I'm sure he's having a fine time. I have no sympathy.
I have no sympathy.
I have no sympathy.
He's in Lisbon.
Philip. Yeah, he's having a great time. Okay, well, since Kelly is here now for the first time for this morning, I'll let you take the first turn.
Okay.
What do you got to tell us about?
Well, you know, every time I'm here, I like to bring some quirky things. And I believe in past years I've done 1,001 Places to See Before You Die, mm-hmm. you know, not to be morbid. Mm-hmm. And I had a bunch of NASCAR books. So this year I brought something that's part of a series. And this particular one is Weird Illinois. And there's also Weird New Jersey, Weird Florida. And it's not your typical travel book. It's set up like a text. And it just talks about bizarre and often fascinating things in this particular state. So I brought Weird Illinois, and I've marked several pages just to kind of go over some strange things that are in here. The first one I've marked here is Creatures of the Watery Deep. And it says, a vast number of creepy creatures are said to lurk in the lakes and ponds of Illinois. One of the most famous was the giant serpent-like Lake Michigan water monster. Hundreds of people on shore and at sea, including fishermen and crewmen on tugboats, reported sightings of the beast throughout the 1800s. But by the early 1900s, it had sunk quietly back into the depths and has not been seen since. And then there's
this was our equivalent of the Loch Ness monster.
Yes, that's right.
I guess.
Exactly. The Illinois Loch Ness.
Exactly. And there's a full page talking about strange creatures that we have found in our ponds, lakes, and rivers. So I thought that was funny. Let's see what else we've got here. We've got a chapter on local heroes and villains. And surprisingly, one that's in there is the man known as the Gentle Giant, mm-hmm. and Robert Pershing Wadlow. And he was born...
Isn't he buried somewhere?
He was born in Alton, Illinois,
yeah. mm-hmm.
in 1918. And he died, I think, at the age of 22. And by the time he was 5 years old, he was 5'4" tall. And by age 8, he was over 6 feet tall and weighed 195 pounds. His parents, brothers, and sisters were all of normal size. So the diagnosis of his rapid growth was caused by pituitary gigantism.
I think you can visit his grave.
Yeah.
I think his, yeah.
So somewhere in Illinois?
Somewhere in Illinois, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I've marked that page. Let's see what else we've got here.
And a lot of these things in the book are actually places that you can go and visit and see.
All of them.
So if you want to take a road trip and just see some wacky stuff,
exactly,
that's what this book is all about.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
I love it too.
Here's the world's largest ketchup bottle, is in fact located along Route 159, just south of downtown Collinsville. And I've also marked where I have been personally into Metropolis to see the Superman statue. And there's all kinds of Superman memorabilia there. So that's always fun.
I would say, the folks in Metropolis figured, now, what could we possibly do to put Metropolis on the map and get people to come here?
And they went for it. And if you drive by on South 57, you can see their water tower. It has Superman on it. And it says Metropolis. And there's a huge statue down in the town square. So, yes. No, they've got the wood cutouts where you can stand, put your head through, so you can be Superwoman or Superman.
Yeah.
I like to do that just as a kind of an ego booster.
Yeah.
And then the last page I marked actually is related to The Wizard of Oz. And it said, somewhere over the rainbow, or at least in a lonesome corner of the Evergreen Memorial Cemetery in Bloomington, lies the worn and weather-beaten grave of a little girl named Dorothy Louise Gage. She was born on June 11, 1898, to Sophie Jewell and Thomas Clarkson Gage, the brother of Maud Gage Baum. Maud was the wife of novelist L. Frank Baum, famous for his wonderful series of books about a magical place named Oz. And so she was the niece of the Baums, and they were delighted at having a girl in the family because apparently it had been all boys. Hmm. And then she suddenly died when she was 5 months old, and so that precipitated his adding the character of Dorothy and writing the story of The Wizard of Oz, and changed her name to Dorothy Gale instead of Gage, but she was the...
So this was Dorothy. Yeah. Well, it's interesting, I'm sure that a lot of people don't know about Baum, is that he was actually a feminist, and that when he set out to write The Wizard of Oz, I think he very deliberately wanted to make the hero a girl.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, I think if I'm remembering this right, both his wife and her mother were very well-known feminist and women's rights activists.
Yes, it does say that in here.
And when he created The Wizard of Oz, he really wanted to write something that would be a distinctively American fairy tale
and deliberate with a female
protagonist. Right. He wanted the hero to be a girl.
And interestingly, when they figured all of this out doing the research, they noted that the tombstone was getting so worn that one of the characters who played a munchkin in the original MGM film had a family business, the Standard Monument Company in St. Louis, for 60 years, and he made plans to go to Bloomington, visit the grave, and then recraft it and get it back up to, isn't that cute?
That's very strange.
That's just Weird Illinois.
All right, that's Weird Illinois. You can find the book at the library. I'm sure that you could, if you wanted to have your very own copy, I'm sure that you could.
You certainly can buy it at Pages.
Go down and buy it at the bookstore. We have a couple of people here who want to join in on the conversation. Mm. Let us do that. First in Champaign, that's line number one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have been reading a series of mysteries by Barbara Cleverly, Cleverly, and indeed they are cleverly written. The first is called The Last Kashmiri Rose. This takes place in India during the 1920s, the early 1920s. And the protagonist and detective is a person by the name of Sandilands. He is a in the British Foreign Service, and it's very interesting because the setting is so unusual, and it's just. It's just a treat to read the setting. And the characters are very, very interesting, very, very interesting. But it's the setting and the mix of the setting and the characters that make it very exciting. So I am a big mystery fan. Oh, by the way, there are, I believe, 4 or 5 books in that series by Barbara Cleverly. And so I'm curious as to what other interesting mysteries abound. I'm not an Aunt Dimity fan, and I think I've read every Agatha Christie and some of the classic other English writers. But I'm looking forward to the next mystery involving Jane Austen, and I can't remember the author's name. So are there any others that in that genre of the amateur woman detective or things would have unusual settings? So if you could tell us about some mysteries.
Well, go ahead, yeah.
Do you read mysteries? Because I don't read a lot.
I do, but mm-hmm. I tend not to run through series. I pick and choose here, there, and everywhere, I guess, because there's so much available at the library. Yeah. I really enjoy Dorothy Kinnell. I don't know if she's read that author before. She is, I think, originally from Great Britain and then moved to Peoria or somewhere in the area. And I don't know if she's still there. She's come to the library and talked before.
Yeah,
but hers
she's
are great
been to the
fun.
Store, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's it's humorous. But it's got a female detective. It's not historical. It's current day. And she gets tossed back and forth usually between the U.S. and England. So maybe that might be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you know is it C-A-N-N-E?
L-L.
L, Dorothy Kinnell. Okay. Mm-hmm. That would be one suggestion for the listener. And you don't have, well, Tanya said she's, you're not a big, I guess you're not a
I don't
big
read a
fan.
Lot of mysteries, really. Sarah Paretsky, I suppose. But although, I don't know, those
she's
are a little
more. She's more of a hard-boiled.
Yeah.
The other, I also like, although this is tending towards the hard-boiled also, because I tend to like Midwestern authors. I don't know why. I also enjoy Eleanor Taylor Bland. Mm-hmm. And she's from Chicago and has a Chicago detective. And she's quite good. She, I think, recently was voted president of the Women's Crime Writers of America. I forget the name of the organization. I talked with her up at one of our conferences. But she's quite good. There's a whole bunch of those Jane Austen read-alikes
yeah,
now
really
that are coming
are.
Out.
Yeah.
If you go to Pages or go to the library and mention that you have an interest in that, they could probably zip you up with some in no time.
There's that Air Affair series.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jasper Ford.
Fjord.
How do you say it, right? Two Fs, right?
Yeah. And I think he has a daughter or somebody that's also writing.
Yeah.
I forget her first name.
Well, I hope that that gives the listener some suggestions.
Thank you.
Let's go to somebody else here. This is a caller in line number 2. I think this is Urbana. Hello.
Yes, it is.
Yes, hi.
Hi. I got to once again recommend the books of Terry Pratchett.
Oh, yeah.
His most recent one, Winter Smith, is the third in a series for young adults, but also the older adults could enjoy it, too, of the Tiffany Aching saga. And it just seems that he gets better and better each time he writes. And he writes a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes. How many books does he have in print?
Oh, my gosh. It's incredible.
30? I don't know. Yeah.
And the young adult stuff is really good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And his take on the world that he's created is really marvelous. Some of it is very satirical.
This Greg?
Huh? Yes, it is.
Hi, Greg.
Hi. And I also like Christopher Moore, who is just a plain whack job. He's written, You Suck, Sucking Fiends, A Love Story.
The Lamb one.
Lamb.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his stuff is just hysterical.
He is funny.
And it's well worth a read if you want something that's just pure and good old escape and entertainment.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm all for it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks. Thank you. Let's talk again here. Someone on our toll-free line, line 4 in Gaze. Hello.
Hello. This might be a little bit off topic, but it's been driving me crazy ever since Media Matters yesterday. A guest alluded to the fact that he had a very well-selling book out, but it was not on the New York Times bestseller list. And what is the basis for the New York Times bestseller list? So who decides? Is it book sales or is it something else?
It's sales, but it's always, people are always a little confused about it because we get the numbers before the week actually happens. It's very bizarre. None of us can really quite figure it out. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, like we get the lists for what's going to be on the New York Times bestseller list.
Before the date
occurs.
How can they decide who's going to be on?
Right.
I don't know if it's a preemptive thing. Like they're guessing the popularity of something. Like today I just got the April 8th one.
Yeah.
And had to base
the one for next
correct.
Week.
That's what we get them a week in advance.
See, and I base some of the purchases at the library based on what that says.
Sure, so. We do too.
But as far as somebody saying his book was, you know, widely sold, that could be
anybody could,
right.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, to me, 50 copies would be wildly sold.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, so I don't know who your
well the isn't. I guess I thought that someone somewhere was polling individual bookstores, and bookstores were keeping track of how many books they've sold, and then they're reporting that to some central location, and then they're adding them all. And it's not every bookstore
certainly
in the country.
Not independent
it's
ones.
Certain chains. It's certain chains that they're relying on, like Books a Million and some of the other big ones in New York and L.A. So some of the things that may be huge on the New York Times bestseller list, I don't and I buy them. You don't think you
nobody
and
cares.
Then they don't do much. And champagne. So I really have to judge that when I'm looking at it.
Yeah, we do too.
So that does. So I guess the bottom line is just because something is said to be a bestseller on their list,
it really doesn't mean anything.
It really
at
doesn't
all.
Mean much of anything. Well, except that people will buy it based on that.
That's right.
Recommendation.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Questions are welcome here. We're doing books here this morning. We have two guests with us in the studio, Tanya Leosakos from Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, and Kelly Strom. She's the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. And every once in a while, we do these books just to get excited about reading and books that we all enjoyed. When the guests are here, they come in and they bring in things that they just thought were fun, were good, were well written, were entertaining. They'd say, just as a recommendation, say, you know, like you would with a friend of yours, to say, look, I read this, I thought it was really good, you might like it too. And that's what we try to do on the programs, in addition to, and get those recommendations from the guests, in addition to having people who are listening also call in with recommendations. We have here in a studio with us Kelly Strom from Champaign Public Library and Tanya Leotsakis from Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And if you're interested in the books that they're recommending, and we may not, they brought probably more than we can actually talk about.
Always do.
Their lists will be posted on our website. So at least by the end of the, I think Tanya's are there already, and we'll have them all there by the end of the day. I'm sorry, Kelly.
You should see the look on her face.
She's wounded. The woman is wounded. Well, Tanya, you know, she came earlier. She was here earlier. Then, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be taken as some lack of regard for your suggestions.
Certainly. All right. You know. I trust you.
All right. We have some other people here to talk with. We will do that in a second. I'm going to give Tanya another turn to make a recommendation.
I would like to recommend The Glass Castle, which is a memoir by Jeanette Walls. She's actually a journalist now, which is just amazing. The resilience of this woman is amazing. She grew up, the portion of the book takes place in the late 60s, early 70s. And her parents were, how should I say this? Her parents were homeless by choice. They were educated people. Particularly her mother was very educated. And her father was more self-educated, but, you know, read a lot, you know, was in her grandmother's household from time to time. Grew up with books. Parents were readers, sort of liberal activists of a kind, but had some serious problems and just sort of were kind of anti-authority and just chose to live, homeless, basically. I mean, they would find places to live occasionally, or old houses and things like that, but they could have been employed. They could have had a regular life, and they were also extremely neglectful in many ways. I mean, in many ways, they were very nurturing, but, I mean, their children were injured frequently, not a lot of food around, a lot of hungry nights. But I wanted to read a passage such an interesting thing is that the woman is so, she loves her parents and she's so matter of fact. The memoir is so matter of fact, as though this is just how it is and this is just how we lived and how my life was. And every once in a while, something happens in the book where you see that her parents, you see why she was so sort of enamored of them. And in fact, the book opens with her, with the author being taken to the hospital because she's been trying to cook hot. She's three. She's been trying to cook hot dogs by herself, and she's scalded herself because her mother wasn't around, and so she actually has scars from this. She burned herself terribly. Mm-hmm. So you think, I mean, these people are just horrible in so many ways, and throughout the whole thing, I mean, infested homes and sleeping on the streets and all kinds of things, which was just completely unnecessary for this particular family. But then things will happen that make you think, well, gosh, you know, she definitely got something from this. She definitely learned something from her parents, and they have made her a certain way that she couldn't have got from anyone else. So I would like to read something that happened with her and her father. He takes her to a zoo. Dad missed the wilderness. He needed to be roaming free in open country and living among untamed animals. He felt it was good for your soul to have buzzards and coyotes and snakes around. That was the way man was meant to live, he'd say, in harmony with the wild, like the Indians, not this Lords of the Earth crap, trying to rule the entire goddamn planet, cutting down all the forests and killing every creature you couldn't bring to heel. One day we heard on the radio that a woman in the suburbs had seen a mountain lion behind her house and had called the police, who shot the animal. Dad got so angry he put his fist through a wall. That mountain lion had as much right to his life as that sour old biddy does to hers, he said. You can't kill something just because it's wild. Dad stewed for a while, sucking on a beer, and then he told us all to get in the car. Where are we going? I asked. We hadn't been on a single expedition since we moved to Phoenix. I missed them. I'm going to show you, he said, that no animal, no matter how big or wild, is dangerous as long as you know what you're doing. We all piled into the car. Dad drove, nursing another beer and cussing under his breath about that innocent mountain lion and the chicken shit suburbanite. We turned in at the city zoo. None of us kids had ever been to a zoo before, and I didn't really know what to expect. Lori said she thought zoos should be outlawed. Mom, who had Maureen in one arm and her sketch pad under the other, pointed out that the animals had traded freedom for security. She said that when she looked at them, she would pretend not to see the bars. At the entrance gate, Dad bought our tickets, muttering about the idiocy of paying money to look at animals, and led us down the walk. Most of the cages were patches of dirt surrounded by iron bars, with forlorn gorillas or restless bears or irritable monkeys or anxious gazelles huddled in the corners. A lot of the kids were having fun, gawking and laughing and throwing peanuts at the animals, but the sight of those poor creatures made my throat swell up. I've got half a mind to sneak in here some night and free these critters, Dad said. Can I help? I asked. He mussed my hair. Me and you, mountain goat, he said, will carry on our own animal prison break. We stopped at a bridge. Below it, in a deep pit, alligators sunned themselves on rocks surrounding a pond. The biddy who got that mountain lion shot didn't understand animal psychology, Dad said. If you let them know you're not afraid, they'll leave you alone. Dad pointed to the biggest, scaliest alligator. Me and that nasty-looking guy's gonna have us a staring contest. Dad stood on the bridge, glowering at the alligator. At first he seemed to be asleep, but then it blinked and looked up at Dad. Dad continued staring, his eyes in a fierce squint. After a minute, the alligator thrashed its tail, looked away, and slid into the water. See, you just have to communicate your position, Dad said. Maybe he would have gone for a swim anyway, Brian whispered. What do you mean, I asked. Didn't you see how nervous that gator got? Dad made him do it. We followed Dad to the lion's den, but the lions were sleeping, so Dad said we should leave them alone. The aardvark was busy hoovering up ants, and Dad said you shouldn't disturb eating animals, so we passed it by and went on to the cheetah's cage, which is about as big as our living room and surrounded by a chain fence. The lone cheetah paced back and forth, the muscles in his shoulders shifting with each step. Dad folded his arms on his chest and studied the cheetah. He's a good animal. Fastest four-footed creature on the planet, he declared. Not happy about being in this damn cage, but he's resigned to it, and he's no longer angry. Let's see if he's hungry. Dad took me to the concession stand. He told the lady running it that he had a rare medical condition and couldn't eat cooked meat, so he'd like to buy a raw hamburger. Yeah, right, the sales clerk said. She told Dad the zoo didn't allow the sale of uncooked meat because foolish people tried to feed it to the animals. I'd like to feed her lard ass to the animals, Dad muttered. He bought me a bag of popcorn, and we returned to the cheetah cage. Dad squatted outside the fence opposite the cheetah. The animal came closer to the bars and studied him curiously. Dad kept looking at him, but not in the angry-eyed way he had stared down the alligator. The cheetah looked back. Finally, he sat down. Dad stepped over the chain fence and knelt right next to the bars where the cheetah was sitting. The cheetah remained still, looking at Dad. Dad slowly raised his right hand and put it up against the cage. The cheetah looked at Dad's hand but didn't move. Dad calmly put his hand between the iron bars of the cage and rested it on the cheetah's neck. The cheetah moved the side of his face against Dad's hand, as if asking to be petted. Dad gave the cheetah the kind of hearty, vigorous petting you'd give a big dog. Situation under control, Dad said, and beckoned us over. We climbed under the chain fence and knelt around Dad while he petted the cheetah. By then, a few people had begun to gather. One man was calling to us to get back behind the chain fence. We ignored him. I knelt close to the cheetah. My heart was beating fast, but I wasn't scared, only excited. I could feel the cheetah's hot breath on my face. He looked right at me. His amber eyes were steady, but sad, as if he knew he'd never see the plains of Africa again. May I pet him, please? I asked Dad. Dad took my hand and slowly guided it to the side of the cheetah's neck. It was soft, but also bristly. The cheetah turned his head and put his moist nose up against my hand. Then his big pink tongue unfolded from his mouth, and he licked my hand. I gasped. Dad opened my hand and held my fingers back. The cheetah licked my palm, his tongue warm and rough like sandpaper dipped in hot water. I felt all tingly. I think he likes me, I said. He does, Dad said. He also likes the popcorn, salt, and butter on your hand. There was a small crowd around the cage now, and one particularly frantic woman grabbed my shirt and tried to pull me over the chain. It's all right, I told her. My dad does stuff like this all the time. He should be arrested, she shouted. Okay, kids, Dad said. The civilians are revolting. We better skedaddle. We climbed over the chain. When I looked back, the cheetah was following us along the side of the cage. Before we could make our way through the crowd, a heavy man in a navy blue uniform came running toward us. He was holding onto the gun and nightstick on his belt, which made him look like he was running with his hands on his hips. He was shouting about regulations and how idiots had been killed climbing into cages and how we all had to leave immediately. He grabbed Dad by the shoulder, but Dad pushed him off and assumed a fighting stance. Some of the men in the crowd clutched Dad's arms, and Mom asked Dad to please do what the guard had ordered. Dad nodded and held out his hands in a peace gesture. He led us through the crowd and toward the exit, chuckling and shaking his head to let us kids know that these fools were not worth the time it would take to kick their butts. I could hear people around us whispering about the crazy drunk man and his dirty little urchin children, but who cared what they thought? None of them had ever had their hand licked by a cheetah.
Yeah. Now, and this is a true...
Yeah, this is a memoir.
It purports to be a true story. This
yes,
is a
indeed,
memoir.
Yeah.
And again, the title is?
The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls.
Okay. We have somebody who has been holding on here very patiently, so let's talk with them in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
For the listener who wanted mysteries, I think some of my favorite ones are by Barbara Neely. I think I've mentioned her before. Her character is Blanche White, who's a very dark African-American woman Barbara Neely explores the stereotype about domestics. She has her own, not Neely, but Blanche White has, which is a play on words, obviously, has her own cleaning service and also does catering. And she's also taken in her dead sister's two children. And Neely explores a lot of social issues in a very interesting way. And because of Blanche's position, she ends up inadvertently becoming a sleuth and sucked into other people's mysteries. One of Neely's books is Blanche and the Talented Tenth. I forget whether that's the one that explores color consciousness among African Americans and class consciousness. There's another one later on where it opens with Blanche seeing this, exploring again another stereotype, which is less common now, which is of an African American man working as a conductor on a train, and she sees this handsome black conductor coming down the aisle when she's on a train, and explores Blanche's relationship with him and the mixed feelings about whether she wants to be tied down. I just think those books are really, really well done. And I called in earlier, about the map that changed the world, I would recommend it not just for people who are interested in natural history stuff, but there's a museum that's opening in Kentucky, a $25 million, something like that, museum that promotes creationism and supposedly shows how the dinosaurs supposedly existed at the same time as human beings and a whole bunch of other rot like that. It's an issue that is not only a question about, you know, do you understand geology and so forth. It laid the foundation for evolution, for Darwin's work, and it has a lot to do with politics in the U.S. today. So I'd recommend it on a lot of levels.
Okay. Thanks. Great. All right. Very good. I just wanted to generally endorse Simon Winchester as a writer, too. Somebody who's written a number of really interesting books. He's somebody who's lucky enough to be able to, it seems like he can write about what he wants. He writes the books he wants to, and he seems actually to have been able to make a living off of his writing.
Doing exactly right.
And how many writers can we say actually can live
very
simply
few.
Off of what they write? Very, very few. Yeah. It just went with like what Kelly was saying before, you know, sometimes you think, if you can sell 50 copies of your book, you're not doing too badly.
That's
and if
right.
you could, if you could sell 2,000, 5,000, that's, you know, for some writers, 10,000 copies would be huge. The number of people that could possibly ever even hope to sell a million is just, you know, forget it.
Yep.
So support your local writers.
That's
ladies
right.
and gentlemen. All right. Other questions are welcome. Other book recommendations are welcome. Here in the studio with me is Tanya Liotsakos from Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, and Kelly Strom. She's the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. So I just want to make sure people understand your job at the library is you're the person who decides what books are purchased and added to the collection?
Yes.
Is it something
Good
that you
girl.
Don't really want to admit?
I always say I have the best job at the library. Absolutely. I get to, of course, read our library journals to see what kind of books are coming out in publishers' catalogs and journals. But I also read things like People Magazine and the New York Times and Good Housekeeping and Parents, because they all have little book literature excerpts in there about mm-hmm. what's hot. And so I always get those. I always get everything that's on Oprah.
See, that's what's fun, but also tough, because you're having to satisfy a very wide cross-section of Champaign-Urbana and people who want all kinds of stuff. And that's they're expecting it to – if they've read about it, they're going to want to go down there and say, oh, why don't you have this book that I want to
read? That happens all the time, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think in this day and age, everything is so – everything is immediate.
Publicized. And,
you know everything, you know, that you would want to know about an author at the flip of a mouse click.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you really have to stay on top of popular culture to do something like that in bookstores or libraries these days.
Yeah. We have somebody here on cell phone. I definitely don't want to make them wait. Let's go to line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to recommend a book that I don't know if it was on your show or Celeste's show, but it was called Hummingbird's Daughter.
That was on Focus 580.
Yes, that was an excellent book.
It's a lovely novel.
Yes, it is. And my question was, I really like magical realism, and I was wanting to know if they could recommend a particular author. I've read all of Isabel Allende's writings, but I kind of need a new place to go to.
You read Gabriel Garcia Marquez?
Yeah, some of his, yes.
Yeah, love him. Gina Nahai, I think it's Nahai. Can you look it up for me, David?
Sure.
Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith is a great magical realism novel. And I think
Moonlight on the Avenue of...
Of Faith.
Okay.
And I think Nahai, I think is her last name.
Yes, Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith by Gina Nahai.
Excellent one.
M-A-N-A-H-A-I. And looks like she also has a couple of other Sunday Silence, Cry of the Peacock, at least a couple of others. And is she Indian?
She's Indian, yes. Uh-huh. Also, Haruki Murakami writes amazing magical realism.
Great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Glad to help out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go back here. I want to give Kelly a chance to talk about another book.
Well, after The Glass Castle, I'm looking at my assortment here, and I'm thinking I'm going to go for something a little light, a little fun to recommend.
Okay.
The first one is one that someone told me about, and I was intrigued because of the title.
The title's great.
Fat Bald Jeff.
Okay.
By Leslie Stella. And this one is about this woman who works in an office building. And what did they say? They said the setting is kind of like Lily Tomlin thrown into a Dilbert cartoon.
That sounds hilarious.
And the title came from in her office, there's all these IT people, computer mm-hmm. people. And several of them are named Jeff. And the one who really knows what he's doing but is also rather cynical about the whole office situation is Fat Bald Jeff, which is how they refer to him.
Sure.
There's Fat Bald Jeff and there's Other Jeff. And so, seriously. And so I brought this one in, and it's – I was going to read a little a bit about what this particular person is like. Saturday passed in its usual dull fashion. I've outgrown the childish excitement that others feel for the weekend. For me, it's just a break in the schedule, like when prisoners get sent out in the yard. Saturday night found me ironing sheets and rehemming my apron. Ever since they changed the stylish length of skirts this year, I've been forced to adapt my wardrobe. Val went to the movies with the Tenants and 2F. He issued a weak invitation as he tied his shoes in the hallway, but I declined. The 2F boys have been snubbing me since they moved in last summer. I don't know why. I brought them a plate of sugar-free wheat flour brownies as a housewarming present and was kind enough to warn them of the hazards presented by their mountain of work boots at the top of the stairs. That's just a little paragraph. But she's so fun because she's got this bizarre sense of humor and this, you know, this anal attitude with how things need to be set up, that watching her try to get this work done and try to talk, like, she got this assignment that she didn't want to do. So she opened up the back of her computer, took her scissors, snipped a wire, and then shoved a candy bar in there and then closed it all back up again. And then said, I'm sorry, my computer doesn't work. I can't do it.
And kids, don't try this at home.
So there's that one. And then the other real quick one that I brought that's just goofy and light and fun, but a word of warning, it's McSteamy. And it's
McSteamy. That is...
No, really. It's called Drive Me Crazy by Nancy Warren. And like I said, this isn't going to win, you know, any Booker Awards here.
No, but it's fun for an afternoon, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's about, and what I kind of like about it is it's about a librarian, but she's really hot. And
well, librarians are all hot.
They
exactly.
are.
That.
You know,
absolutely.
Some yeah. people just don't know that.
So sometimes people don't understand at
they
all.
Don't get it.
I know.
So this displays that. She's in a very small town in Oregon, and she gets involved in a mystery at the library.
Cool.
Now,
dealing with a missing Van Gogh painting.
From the library?
No.
Oh. Oh, okay.
No,
it's all tied in.
Oh, okay.
You'll see.
All right. I'll take your word. I'm just still thinking about McSteamy.
That's a great
Now, I'm guessing, I think I know what that means, but it's...
You know what it means.
It's like, you know...
It's yeah. it's hot.
It's hot.
Oh, there's explicit okay. language in this
oh,
one.
Oh, well, I wouldn't. I'm sorry, I couldn't really do that. But, you know, some other people could. I mean, I'm just thinking about how now, you know, McDonald's is angry at the Oxford English Dictionary for including McJob in the dictionary. So we maybe have to be very, very careful about McAnything.
Okay.
About using that. You know, McDonald's, they're very upset about that. So we have to just be, you know, very, very careful. You don't want to get them mad.
No.
Well, you don't want to have Ronald McDonald knocking at your door at midnight.
No, I don't. I'll tell you that right now. It's like I should change it to, I don't know if you guys saw the Music and Lyrics movie with Hugh Grant. I enjoy Hugh Grant, so I have to go see his movies. But there's like this joke about this young girl and who's this rock star, well, pop star, and she says her music is steamy and sticky.
Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It isn't even noon yet. Well, we have about 5 minutes left on this show, and I'm going to give Tanya at least one more chance to redeem us.
Oh my gosh!
With something that you know has some social significance.
Okay, I'm not going to read from this one because we only have 5 minutes. But this is another memoir called Love. I've been reading so many memoirs lately. I usually read novels, but love this. It's called Love is a Mixtape. Life and Loss, One Song at a Time. It's by Rob Sheffield. He's a writer for Rolling Stone. Picked it up because I said, why do I know his name? Why have I seen that 1,000 times? He writes for Rolling Stone. So basically his wife died. He married pretty young, and his wife died when they were, you know, not even 30. And it's kind of like his life before and after her death and how you deal with being a really young widower. But the greatest thing about the book, this is a book for music lovers for sure, contemporary music lovers. Each chapter starts with a mixtape that either he or she or the two of them have made together. And it gives you the tracks on each of the mixtapes.
Awesome.
And so you feel so identified with this guy if you like the same kind of music at all. And it's full. It's sort of full of pop culture music references and things like that. And so, yeah, exactly. I
and
know.
Who doesn't have a closet full of mixtapes?
Exactly, a closet full of mixtapes. And so each chapter sort of represents, like, you know, the tape, the tracks on the tape represent like this particular sentiment for him or this particular time period in their lives or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's sad, but it's also really funny. And if you're a contemporary music lover at all, then.
Cool.
Definitely.
You know, the
book.
Kids today, they don't know about mixtapes.
No.
Yeah, no. Yeah. No. And he actually addresses that. He actually does address
well,
that.
Well, that's basically what their MP3 players and
iPods
are. It's just
sure.
one
you
big
can burn
hairy
someone a CD.
Tape.
It is.
Oh, that's very progressive and in tune with the kids.
It's very true.
Because in her job, she's got to be in tune with the kids.
Mm-hmm. Of course she does.
All right. I'm going to talk with one more person here, Inner Banna, at least one more person here on line one. Hello.
Hello. For the sake of the woman who was hoping to find references for mysteries involving kind of amateur people in unusual settings, I'd like to recommend the Alexander McCall Smith series.
Those are, actually, I like those. And I never read mysteries.
Well, we have one thumbs up and we have thumbs. I actually, yeah. I have read them and I talked with him here on the show a couple of years ago.
Oh,
and
I missed him.
He was a charming fellow and I actually enjoyed reading them. These are the mysteries. The number one ladies detective agency was
the first
one. I
read two of them. I enjoyed them.
And he has a series and it's about a woman who is a detective and lives in, is it Botswana?
Yes. And she doesn't set out to solve mysteries. It's just mysteries sort of present themselves to her. And at pages, I think, they're usually set aside as the gentle mysteries. And I really have enjoyed them and recommended them to many of my friends. And because of the setting and because you learn a lot about Botswana, when you just read the stories and read what she read the thinking of the main character, I thought that the lady who was interested might like to read these.
Sure. Well, I appreciate the recommendations.
Those are highly popular.
They are. I think gentle is a nice word. They're not. If you like hard boiled mysteries, no. This is not going to be for you. But they're very sweet, and they do, I think, give you a sense of place. I think that they really. I think you get a good feeling for what it would be like to live there, and I think that that's nice in that respect too. So yeah, I appreciate the recommendation.
Thank you very much.
And they're all in paperback, I think.
Yeah, they're all in paperback.
I think the last one
is still in hardcover, but soon.
Yeah, and he does also have a series of novels that has another female protagonist who is a Scottish.
And they're not mysteries.
They're not? I thought they were mysteries.
I don't think they are mysteries, no.
Oh, okay.
He also has a children's book series, too.
He's written a lot of books.
Yeah.
He's an interesting guy. We're almost at the point we have to finish. Do you want to, Kelly, you want to pitch one more thing?
I kind of cheated the last time and did two, though.
No, go.
You're our special guest.
You've hardly said a word.
Yes, really. We can't pry the words out of the woman.
I don't even know where to begin. I've got a couple others that you'll see on the webpage later on. And one of them, I have to say, touched me in a way. It's called Rosie Dunn, D-U-N-N. It's by Cecilia Ahern. And she's also the author of P.S. I Love You, which I think a lot of people read when that came out. This one I really liked because it's about a boy and a girl who were friends like from the age of five, and they'd wrote little notes to each other. And the whole book is made up of their notes and letters. And so it starts off at age five with their little, will you come over to my house and play? And then it gets later on when they're married to other people and have kids. And, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. And, oh, I miss you. And the whole thing, whether they get together at the end. And it touched me because I have a daughter who was friends with a little boy since age of five. And I kept thinking, will this happen to them?
Oh, that's so cute.
She'd kill me if she knew I just mentioned that.
All right. She probably doesn't listen to public radio.
Oh, let's hope not. She's in school.
All right. Well, I think we're going to have to finish. All the books that we have recommended and some that we haven't, they'll be on our website. So if you want to get authors and titles, do that. In the meantime, if you're looking for book recommendations, go to the bookstore, go to Pages, find Tanya, or ask some of her coworkers. Go to the library, talk with the people there. They know about the books. And if you're looking for something, some particular kind of book, just ask.
Absolutely.
And they will, I'm sure, try real hard to get you hooked up with the book because that's what they do.
And we have great recommendations on the website also, www.champagne.org.
Excellent.
Fantastic website.
Tanya Leotsakis from Pages for All Ages in Savoy, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Kelly Strom, Collection Manager at the Champaign Public Library, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.